This is the Cato Daily Podcast for Wednesday, September 24th, 2014. I'm Caleb Brown. When the Supreme Court spoke on the subject of police searches of mobile phones incident to arrest, they spoke clearly and with one voice: get a warrant. Cato Senior Fellow Jim Harper discussed the twin cases of Riley and Worry at Cato's Constitution Day held last week.
The Riley decision is based on two cases that I thought was interesting, were argued separately, Riley and Worry. Riley, the one that the opinion was issued under, was the case of an individual in California who was properly arrested with a smartphone in his possession. It's a given in the case that he was properly arrested. The smartphone in his possession, law enforcement accessed and saw information that led them to believe that he was a gang member. Further investigation based on that information caused further charges to be leveled against him. And upon conviction, he challenged the use of the cell phone data in gathering that information for those further charges. Worry was a different case in which another man, properly arrested, had a flip phone. And the flip phone had, as flip phones do, quite a bit less information. But the flip phone's ringing displayed an image, displayed the text "My House," and opening the flip phone enabled law enforcement to access the telephone number that correlated to "My House," and then using a reverse lookup service, find out what house that was, go to the house, further investigate, where they found further incriminating materials against Worry. My suspicion is, and it would have followed the typical pattern, that these two cases were argued separately on the premise that there might be different outcomes in the two cases. Perhaps you could certainly, ahead of time, envision that one case, the smartphone case, might reflect a constitutional intrusion because of the vast amount of data that is on a smartphone. And the flip phone case may not have. And it would have been a very, very interesting line-drawing exercise if the court had come to the conclusion that one was an illegal search and one was a legal search. I think they set themselves up originally for that possible outcome. They didn't come to that conclusion, though, and it was a unanimous opinion combining the two cases in the Riley decision. The issue area being explored, of course, was the search incident to arrest doctrine, which some of you may remember from law school, and a few of you who have been defendants may know about it more intimately. The basic doctrine is laid out by the Schimel decision in 1969. In that case, if I recall the facts correctly, a person was arrested in his home, and law enforcement used the fact of the arrest in his home to search quite broadly within the home for whatever interested them. The court found that that was not an appropriate search, that the appropriate search incident to arrest rests on two rationales. One is a search that'll ensure the safety of the officers, so a search for weapons on the person, a search for weapons nearby, other instruments, removing instruments from an individual who might try to use them to elude law enforcement to escape. The other is the likely loss of evidence. If you leave evidence with a defendant, with a suspect, they could try to destroy the evidence. They could try to eat it, throw it away, step on it, crush it into the ground, whatever it may be. And so it's perfectly reasonable under the Fourth Amendment to search an arrestee in the interest of gathering evidence. Perhaps the apex of the search incident to arrest doctrine was a case called Robinson in 1973, from which the container doctrine arose. Robinson was arrested, to give you some local flavor, was arrested at 8th and C Street Northeast, just a few blocks from where I live now. It's a better neighborhood now. And he was arrested for a driving infraction. And in the course of the arrest, they patted him down, found a cigarette pack that was crumpled up in his shirt pocket. No chance whatsoever that a crumpled cigarette pack in the shirt pocket could have any further evidentiary use with regard to the arrest. But nonetheless, law enforcement officers searched the crumpled pack, found heroin capsules inside, and arrested Robinson. The court approved that arrest on a broad search incident to arrest doctrine. And since then, in subsequent cases, had started to pare back cases where law enforcement had searched a large trunk, a luggage container that was proximate to the arrestee, and so on and so forth. So there's the search incident to arrest doctrine and container doctrine. The argument on the government side was that a cell phone, a flip phone, or a smartphone is equivalent to a container. It happens to contain a lot of information, but it's roughly the same as a small parcel or item you might carry on your person. The court said no. And again, combining the two cases, said the following. I'll just read the penultimate paragraph from Chief Justice Roberts' decision. Modern cell phones are not just another technological convenience. With all they contain and all they may reveal, they hold for many Americans the privacies of life, citing to Boyd, 1886, a major case about the home. The fact that technology now allows an individual to carry such information in his hand does not make the information any less worthy of the protection for which the founders fought. Our answer to the question of what police must do before searching a cell phone seized incident to an arrest is accordingly simple. Get a warrant. Now, I like that quote. I think that's a fascinating, clear quote, and I think it was an affirmative choice on the part of Justice Roberts and perhaps other justices working with him on the opinion. I like that outcome. I like that language, and I like the unanimity of the opinion, which still is quite rare with the court. But in my opinion, that the outcome in the case and the language provides a direction, but not a path for Fourth Amendment doctrine in future cases. In his article, Andrew Pincus goes through many of the same cases that I would. The Kelo decision, K-Y-L-L-O, not K-E-L-O, the property rights decision, in 2001, in which Justice Scalia found that the use of a thermal imager to survey the side of a home and discover heat waves emanating from it was a search. The Jones case, more recently, just a few years ago, found that attaching a GPS device to a car and using the fact of that GPS device being attached to the car over a period of 4 weeks to collect 2,000 pages of information about where that car has been is a search. Pincus went into the Maryland v. King case, which is not so much a search case, but a case about the privacy consequences of gathering DNA evidence from arrestees. And then this case, Riley and Wurie, its companion case, the check of a cell phone properly taken from an arrestee, its contents, and that being a search. I think you take direction from that, but certainly in the Riley case, I don't think we got any further elucidation of what doctrine the Supreme Court will use in the future with the Fourth Amendment. It's notable, I think, that in the Kelo decision, Justice Scalia did not rely on the reasonable expectation of privacy test that comes from Justice Harlan's concurrence in Katz versus United States, 1967. Neither was the reasonable expectation of privacy test used in the Jones case. And here in Riley, the court did not rely explicitly on the reasonable expectation of privacy test, though many, many commentators assume that the basis of the test was the reasonable expectation, or the basis of the outcome was the reasonable expectation of privacy test. That test, I've written several times and say every chance I get, is a backward test. It reasons backward from expectations to constitutional protection, and it doesn't work. Most people know that it's circular, that in the modern era, there's a sort of battle going on. What are our expectations with regard to modern communications? Well, if the government can pound down on them far enough, then they get to access them constitutionally. Whereas if we convince ourselves that we do have privacy, then we get constitutional protection. That's no basis for constitutional decision making. The path that I argue for and have argued for in briefs to the Supreme Court is to really follow the inspiration of Terry versus Ohio. That's the very familiar case that was decided just shortly after Katz, in which law enforcement espying a couple of shady characters looking like they're doing shady things, law enforcement officers seized them briefly, searched them, and found a gun. Terry versus Ohio ratified that. More importantly than the outcome was the fact that the Terry court explicitly noted the existence of a seizure and then explicitly noted the existence of a search. The seizure was stop here, you don't go anywhere. The search was the patting, and the feeling of a hard object against the hand was the search that revealed the existence of a gun. If Fourth Amendment doctrine is to be administered well, I think the Supreme Court should return to Terry-like decisions and follow as closely as possible the actual text of the Fourth Amendment. do not use reasonable expectation doctrine to reason backward from expectations to constitutional protection. Rather, courts should ask first, was there a seizure? I ask first about seizures, though the phrase is search and seizure, because very often searches are preceded by a seizure. Was there a seizure? That's the taking of some property right, however small. And the Jones case is a good illustration of the taking of a very small property right. The attachment of a small, lightweight GPS device to the underside of a car converts that car to law enforcement's purposes. It violates even a slender reed of that narrow right to exclude that's at the center of property rights. Things that are yours for any reason and every reason, and someone else can't come along and claim they have a better reason why they should take these things. It's the essence of property rights, the right to exclude. In my brief to the court on that case, I cited Tony Honoré, the sort of the legal philosopher who goes more deeply into the incidents of property that are so important. Was there a seizure, even a small seizure? We can talk about whether or not it was reasonable. And the way I think about it, there can be reasonable seizures when they're small enough, when their consequences are minimal. More importantly and more directly, was there a search? And more often, cases deal with whether or not there was a search. In the Kelo case, using a thermal imager to make things visible that were otherwise invisible to law enforcement using Outre technology was a search. Law enforcement were standing on public property. They didn't invade a property right by walking onto Kelo's land. But they used a high-tech device to take things that were otherwise not perceptible and make them perceptible. That's searching, almost literally. And like some kind of fool, I often cite Black's Law Dictionary to the Supreme Court of the United States, because I believe they should stick to natural language as best they can to administer the law well. The final question, and the question where the judging must happen, is was the seizure or search reasonable? There can be reasonable seizures. There can be reasonable searches. Under reasonable expectation doctrine, all the questions are usually collapsed together. And the finding of a search, which upsets a reasonable expectation of privacy, is almost always unconstitutional. But follow that path like you're implementing a law, a statute as written. Was there a seizure? Was there a search? Was it reasonable? Well, did the court take all of the Cato Institute's advice at the end of my pen with the valuable assistance of colleagues here at Cato? Not really. And the case, I think, in Riley was notable for the fact that it really, really avoided a lot of the issues that had been raised in past cases. Justice Roberts wrote the opinion where I would have expected Justice Scalia to do it, because he's taken so many of these cases over recent years. The opinion was unanimous. Justice Alito wrote a concurring opinion that didn't reveal much more. And I suspect that the reason why the case was handled this way is because the court recognizes that matters of Fourth Amendment import and intense interest are coming their way. I speak of the NSA spying cases making their way through the DC circuit and through the Second Circuit in New York right now. It's a guess based on no knowledge whatsoever. I will stand up here and just guess before you that the court determined that it should not tip its hand either way on some of the doctrinal issues that I think will affect the NSA spying cases coming their way. Again, November 4th is an important date in upcoming, because the D.C. Circuit will hear argument in the case in this jurisdiction. Andrew Pincus's article goes into some of the major issue areas that you can expect Riley and the previous cases to affect in the near future, and that's valuable reading for folks who are getting into this area. The question whether email is constitutionally protected, the third-party doctrine, which is the argument the government uses to maintain the NSA spying program, would hold that all emails are available to the government without a warrant. And the Warshak case in the Sixth Circuit found otherwise. That may make it to the court before too long. Cell phone location data, a matter of intense interest that you may see Fourth Amendment arguments on soon, and border searches is a very important, very interesting issue application of the Fourth Amendment at the borders. So I commend to you again Andrew Pincus's article. Thanks for your interest in these issues, and I love to see the idea that we'll tie them all together during the Q&A. Thank you.
Jim Harper is a senior fellow at the Cato Institute. Get your copy of Cato's Supreme Court Review at our website, cato.org.